Without trust, society stagnates.
Economies decline.
And businesses fail.
My Security Media believes through security,
trust between individuals,
organisations,
and government can be maintained. Welcome to the
Cybersecurity Weekly Podcast.
Welcome to My Security Media's Cybersecurity Weekly Podcast and recording from Barcelona at Kaspersky Labs Next Media Forum, and joined by Dmitry Golov, Denis Makrushin, and Laurie Pycroft. Gents, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting
us. Thanks for coming.
Very good. So Dmitry and Denis, you're both with Kaspersky Lab, and Laurie, you're with Oxford University,
yep.
And we're going to kick off with you. This particular interview is going to be talking about brain implants, brain memory, and the type of sort of research that's going on into not just artificial intelligence, but the matching between almost the transhuman aspects of what we're doing, particularly around medical research. And it's really humans and machines coming together, is it not?
Absolutely. And this has been going on in some form or another for quite a while. The earliest brain stimulation experiments go back to the late 19th century. But the real melding of implanted devices into humans being used on a routine basis goes back to the mid-80s, when these devices first started becoming widely available enough and easy enough to build that the treatment became feasible. And since then, it's advanced very rapidly. You know, we've gone from very simple stimulation mechanisms to much more complex implants that use machine learning to optimize treatment. The most cutting edge ones will engage in what's known as closed loop stimulation. So this is recording from and stimulating the brain at the same time, using the recording to influence stimulation based on a prediction of how best to ameliorate the defective signal within the brain. And yeah, it's absolutely melding machine and man.
But the devices themselves, the implants, are now starting to be controlled, and the firmware being controlled by Bluetooth and being linked into applications on a smart device or a tablet.
Absolutely. So the current generation and most cutting-edge implants are integrating with smartphone apps or tablet apps in order to enable people to control them with greater ease than the old-school dedicated programmers that they used to have, big, ugly, chunky things, which obviously the patient likes. And it also improves the standard of care, as increasingly they're able to engage in remote diagnostics and telemetry, and eventually we're going to be seeing essentially offloading a lot of the functions of people's brains onto the cloud by integrating with networks in order to provide a better, more complex computational capability than implanted devices on their own are able to.
So the way you've rolled out sort of the next 20 years, the 2020s, we'll start to see electronically recorded brain signals. Then we'll be able to enhance those, rewrite and reinstall them. 2030s, we'll start to see commercially available memory boosting technology. And by the 2040s, extensive control over memories, both ours and others. Now then, that really leads us around to the cybersecurity issue. We haven't solved information security, computer security and cybersecurity for the last 20 years. So with that type of projection, Dmitry, what's it looking like in terms of cybersecurity for implanted devices in a human brain?
Yeah, that's a good question. And you've mentioned the map of our evolvement, yeah, how this medical stuff will evolve. So cybersecurity has to be at the edge too, because for now we have to observe some simple vulnerabilities in very simple devices. But when it gets more and more complicated, we should be ready for the possible vulnerabilities and possible exploitations. And for us now, we can say that we've never seen like massive attacks in the wild, and this only means that we have some more time before that happens or hopefully doesn't happen because we are doing something.
Laura, you mentioned, I think you mentioned that from a number perspective, there's only about 1,000 people with brain implants at the moment.
About 100,000.
Oh, bigger part, 100,000. Yeah. Okay. So we can potentially get it on a mass.
Yeah. So currently we haven't observed that.
Okay.
But if we are trying to find some vulnerabilities and we do that, it's just a question of time when we can face it in the wild. So we have to be prepared both on the technical side, providing some security solutions for the people and the patients and medical institutions. And on the other hand, just provide the awareness for the people who are using it on the daily basis or as medical specialists, implants and that, and working with the programmers, for them to be aware about the cybersecurity problems and some simple rules they have to follow just to decrease the probability of something to happen.
So it's going to need requirements from both the patient or the implantee and the implanter and then the clinicians on the side. Dennis, so bring it around to your presentation because you were doing sort of live workshops of existing vulnerabilities in the healthcare sector already. And we've seen this in Australia and elsewhere, by the way, in terms of the healthcare sector is being actively targeted now and successfully. So what are your observations around existing vulnerabilities and are they really learning?
Existing vulnerabilities, and I think the state of medicine right now, it's like a state of our computers 10 years ago or state of our SCADA system 10 years ago, because the medicine is not investing the time and not investing the resources and budgets in cybersecurity. For them, cybersecurity is something like, okay, it's another domain, it's probably not actual for us, we don't be a victim of any attacker, but we have seen a lot of incidents, breaches, leakages from any kind of medicine facilities. So the attention of attackers switched to the medicine, and we have seen that in a number of vulnerabilities, a number of incidents, just proof that idea that medicine is the next crown of jewel for attackers.
Well, I think it's already there. That's where all the health records are kept. So from an identity theft perspective, you're even down into potential biometric information as well. So, Laurie, in terms of your research, maybe explain to the audience what your research is and what's brought you together with Kaspersky Lab as to... This is obviously a whole field, new field of research as well.
So back in 2016, I published a paper that was discussing an idea that I've been throwing around for a while, which is that these implants, the deep brain stimulation implants, are the main area focused on, although it's worth noting there are all different kinds of neurological implants. It's just been easier and more straightforward to focus on one case study that I'm most familiar with. But I published this paper that was trying to catalog the potential threats that an attacker, an adversary, could implement if they had the desire and the technical capability. I want to do this as a thought exercise to provoke debate and provoke a more serious consideration of cybersecurity in these implants and to explore some of the more metaphysical questions that are posed when we start talking about an attacker modulating and interfering with someone's brain function. So I've been working on this for a little while, and last year Kaspersky got in touch, the Global Research Analysis Team, and were interested in collaborating on the project. I thought that it sounded really cool, and as someone who has more of a physiological background than a cybersecurity one, you know, having the expertise on board to do the serious cybersecurity work was really valuable. And I think so far we've had quite a profitable and useful collaboration.
Oh, okay, so there's potential commercial opportunities here, I'd imagine, as well.
Well, when I say profitable, I mean in the intellectual sense.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, sorry, I forgot you're an academic.
Yeah.
Dimitri, I think Kaspersky Lab has done research in hospital security in the past. So obviously,
this
a sort of extension of what you were saying.
Well,
there.
We are always trying to observe new fields of studies and new fields of technologies that are somewhere in the middle of cybersecurity and informational technologies and something else. So yeah, that's not the first time when we are doing medical researches, and before that Dennis was, by the way, doing the research with medical facilities and different medical institutions and security inside them. So, but from our side, when we thought about new implantable devices security, we also were trying to find someone who knows how it works from the other side, who is really implementing some new technologies. So we collaborated with one of the best laboratories we found at that time, that was Oxford University. And it was kind of profitable, not in an intellectual way. Yeah, because for us it's the question of awareness, as I told before, and the question of researching everything new and everything potential vulnerable.
But I think that's where the key aspect, something that I think Laurie raised, was the vulnerabilities are going to be there because you need backdoors into these devices in case there is a medical emergency, if the patient's unconscious. There is really going to be inherent vulnerabilities in this anyway, and obviously risk of, if your brain is connected to the internet or to the cloud, we're already getting mass influence of elections from social media, let alone, and I've raised this about avatars as well and chatbots and how they can potentially influence behaviour. Whereas if you can upload and download memories, goodness knows what the bad guys are going to be looking at next. It's an Aladdin's cave, is it not?
Well, absolutely. And, from election hacking to influence campaigns to just the background noise of weird information on the internet, I think there's good reason to be concerned. If you look at the chatbot Tay, took all of 12 hours, I think, for her to go from, say, her anthropomorphizing the chatbot, but to go from, simple, typical chatbot behavior to spouting Nazi propaganda. It's a long-term risk, and it's something that doesn't need to be worried about right now. But it's conceivable that we see in the future tapping your brain directly into the internet would have some really troubling implications. We need to be thinking about security for the future so we can minimize the risk of these bad outcomes and hopefully maximize the risk of getting great technology that enhances our lives and doesn't turn us into weird info zombies or something.
Well, that's probably worst case scenario. If anyone's interested in this, is Elon Musk has got the Neuralink company that they've started that are looking at this. You yourself have an implant as a diabetic. Maybe just talk us through that and how that's working for you in terms of enhancing your life and how it works.
Sure. So I've got what's known as a freestyle Libre. So this is a little device that attaches to my skin and has an implanted sensor that goes inside. It's quick and painless to put on. I put on a new one every 2 weeks and with a little device that goes chunk onto my skin, implants it, and it measures my interstitial fluid glucose, which is basically a way of measuring blood glucose. And it connects to a little device that I can wirelessly scan over it that updates it. Now, I've got an add-on for it that's not licensed, but it's very effective. It takes that raw data and sends it via Bluetooth to my phone, which means I can get updates when my blood glucose is heading low or high. It has a predictive algorithm that, based on my previous responses, will estimate how my blood glucose is going to change in response to a certain meal or a certain bolus of insulin. And it's absolutely life-changing. I spent a few months as a diabetic without it, and they were miserable. I was stabbing my fingers all the time, trying to get blood out for the very hungry blood scanner machine that seemed to always want more. Since getting the Libre, it's massively improved my quality of life and has hugely improved my ability to manage my blood glucose. Now, as someone who's working tangentially with cybersecurity now, I am very aware that it's a hideously insecure system, more so than any neurological implant that's being produced at the moment. I've got this unlicensed add-on that's sending out Bluetooth data about my blood glucose, and that's something I am concerned about. But the utility of the implant is so great that it's a risk I'm more than willing to take. And I think that's very telling about medical cybersecurity generally. These are devices with functions that are so wonderful, so impactful on the lives, that even if there is a very big risk, it's worth taking.
Yep.
So, in a way, patients are coerced into that that choice. You know, they're made to make the choice to have a good health and sacrifice the information security that ideally we would all enjoy, which is why I think, and incidentally, this whole project started way before I became diabetic. It's just, or no,
right,
knew
okay.
I was diabetic. It's just a kind of, I guess, happy coincidence, a bit of a silver lining to getting the disease, that I now feel quite a deep connection to the work, and it really underlines for me how important getting the security right is.
Well, it takes the convenience versus security factor to a whole new level, as you
Absolutely.
Say, it's about quality of life.
But that's not the choice. It's always like you shouldn't choose between like features and security and safety. We should find some kind of a balance.
Yeah.
And for now, we can see that the industry is trying to do that, producing different regulations and mitigations, and they are trying to collaborate together. And this is the best point we can get. So, for example, patients, like in the best world we have, a patient shouldn't choose, like, I will get this unverified add-on just to be, like, to feel better. This is a great opportunity. But as security guys, we should
yep.
think about security. You know?
Well, you've got to have the two there together. So, look, we'll finish it there. We could literally talk all day. We've been joined by Dmitry Golov and Denis Makarushin, both from Kaspersky Lab, and Laurie Pycroft from Oxford University. Thank you very much for joining us on the Cybersecurity Weekly podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming.